Hello and welcome to Scoreheads, a brand new podcast dedicated to the love of the music of both big and small screens, born out of a mutual respect and unwavering admiration for the folks that write the scores featured in all of your favourite films, television series and video games. This, my friends, is a show that celebrates that very same music and the creators of it by sitting down with the many maestros involved industry-wide to hear their stories about making the notes that emote. I'm John Brown, host of Film Podcast We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod, alongside Paul Marsh, available here via this very same channel, so do check that out. And you can hear me on Express FM all week round as the station's resident film correspondent, and also every other Sunday night at 6 p.m. in the UK as the host of soundtrack-focused, interview-based specialist radio show, The Composer Series. Joining me on this journey is my podcast partner, with whom I am in soundtrack collecting cahoots, journalist, author, film music historian, fellow film score nerd, and top quality gent, Sean Wilson. Sean, how are you, mate?
I'm very good, thanks, sir. I think the most important word in all that was nerd, and I proudly live by that.
We are indeed film music nerds, and I can easily answer why I asked you. We share a common understanding, appreciation and enthusiasm for the art form, and your work, especially your book, by the way, is exceptional. And for me, I'm very, very lucky to have you on the team with me and very grateful to you, mate, for your time. But enough of that. Tell us about your book.
People can't see, I'm actually blushing. I'm being very, very humble. Yeah, so we'll just... Just a bit about me then. I'm 35 at time of recording, about to become 36-year-old film soundtrack journalist from Silla Whippersnapper, from Bristol, UK. Yeah, author of The Sound of Cinema, Hollywood Film Music, From the Silence to the Present Day. And yeah, I've been infused with a love of film music, I think, ever since I first saw maybe Raiders of the Lost Ark on BBC when I must have been about 8. And John Williams just imprinted on my brain. I'm sure you were the same as well, right?
Oh, I was. It was Star Wars for me. I think I told you this story many times before. Star Wars and Superman the movie, Richard Donner's Superman the movie, and the OG Star Wars, 1977, the first, or episode 4 as it's now referred. Those are the two video cassettes that I remember being on constant repeat in my house when I was but a wee boy in nappies, apparently. And I was so in love with John Williams' score for, and of course both those films are scored by John Williams, so I think it was set in stone really from birth that I was going to be a huge John Williams fan. But John Williams' music had so much of an impact on me and resonated with me emotionally, so much so that apparently in my school play when I was very small, I was meant to be Joseph in the Nativity, and I can't remember what the line I was given was, but apparently when I came out on stage, the only thing I said was, "Dan, da 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 dan, Superman!" And thus begins my love for John Williams at the tender age of 5. But yeah, ever since then, I mean, E.T., Raiders, even Schindler's List, the list goes on and on and on. The literal list goes on and on and on. And his music and his work is an inspiration to everyone, I think. I don't think there's anyone that doesn't have a John Williams story, or at the very least, doesn't have a memory of where they haven't connected with it in some way. Like, even people that don't collect scores like we do, or aren't into soundtracks or movies like we are, everyone knows the name John Williams, right?
Yeah, they do. And well, I think from my point of view, as a child of 1987, I was lucky to grow up with the composers that followed in John Williams' footsteps. You think of Alan Silvestri, you think of James Horney, you think of all those classic melodic artists. There was a really, really rich wellspring of very thematically driven scores from John Williams and from the people who followed after him. And I consider myself very, very fortunate to have grown up in that period. And ultimately, it all comes out in the wash in the form of me doing what I do, me writing my book, which traces, you know, the 127-year history of film music, right from the Nickelodeon era, right the way through to the modern era of Hans Zimmer and Lorne Balfe. And yeah, I credit artists like John Williams with setting me on that journey, I think.
growing up in the, I mean, I just clipped the 70s. I was 79. There we go. I've said my age without saying my age. You're very brave saying your age, Sean. I have
That's
to say.
Subtle.
but as a child of the 80s, like yourself, I think we were. Yeah, we were very lucky to have been alive at that time and to witness this evolution of film music. Jerry Goldsmith, Alan Silvestri, John Williams, Michael Kamen even. You know, we were very, very lucky and very fortunate. James Horner, of course. The names just keep coming. Shirley Walker. The list goes on and on. But it seemed like a really good... The 70s and the 80s is a really good time for the development and evolution of what I call romantic film scores. Not romantic in the sense of the context of the film, but just the romance and falling in love with the film music sound as I grew up. And I always thought, you know, everybody else at school was into whatever was in the charts at the time, but I was always really like, but I really like the music in that, or the music in that. I didn't understand how to put that into words, if that makes sense. I just knew that I didn't like, I did like popular music, of course, but my first love was always drawn towards the music I heard within films. And so the first record or LP that I ever bought was Back to the Future, just so I could have those like two tracks of Alan Silvestri score, whatever was on there.
Never mind Huey Lewis in the News. It was all about Alan's work.
It was all about Alan Silvestri. And I was very fortunate to be able to tell him as much to his face, which was a great privilege. And yeah, this is an exciting journey I think we're about to embark on. We've been on a reasonably exciting journey, I would say, separately. I say I love all your work. And
likewise, I love yours as well. The Composed series, brilliant.
Bless
you, sir. I love the fact that you fly the flag for that in audio form, because I mean, so much of this stuff is written down. The fact that you can hear engagement with these artists is brilliant. I love that.
Well, that's why we brought you on, my friend, because now you too are going to do that. We're going to engage. I know you do this. Obviously, you interview many composers for your book, and also you interview many composers for other projects that you work on, for people like Film Score Monthly and the Composer Magazine and things like that. But here we are together, a combined force, if you will, a dynamic duo in which we will sit together and quiz composers and pick their brains. And seriously, by his book, it's amazing. Where, Sean? Tell us where.
So it's available from Amazon, Blackwells and Waterstones via McFarland's publishers. And I will shout out McFarland, who are fantastic collaborators in the creation of the book. Really, really supportive. But yeah, if you want to embark on a magical journey through time and space as filtered through the medium of film music, yeah, please do go and pick it up and let me know what you think.
Do that now. I have it. It's brilliant. I often refer to it, actually, if I'm stuck for a nugget of information. So please do get yourself a copy if you love film music as much as we do. However, here we are, episode one. So on to the meat of it, I say. You're not here for us. You're here for the big guns and what talent we have for you the first time out, dear listener. For this very first episode, we're very proud to present to you an uncut edition of an interview you may have heard smaller segments of, perhaps on We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod, or maybe even over on Express FM or the Composer Series. But here right now, for the very first time ever, Sean and I are very excited to present to you our interview, uncut, with legendary composer Tyler Bates and his amazing daughter Lola Collette in its full, over an hour long, entirety. Sean, when you got the call that we were going to do this one, what were you most excited about once we took the booking with these two awesome souls?
Well, I think I was so excited I couldn't actually form words. I was kind of like, ah! Oh, I think that was a noise that kind of came out, because, yeah, Tyler has done some you know, really, 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 really fascinating work on the like the Guardians of the Galaxy scores for Marvel. And it was an interesting setup going in, because I was thinking, I've never actually tackled a kind of father-daughter interview setup before, and I thought that was going to be a very interesting dynamic, and indeed it turned out to be very interesting. They were both absolutely sublime, and such a lot of ground to cover with both of them. It's kind of hard to know where to start, isn't it, with these guys?
But start we did, Yeah. Start we did. We got it done, and it was the... Yeah, we had an absolutely brilliant time, and it, as I said, it's a real thrill to work with my friend. But Sean and I sat down with them a few weeks ago to talk about Lola's rise as an artist, musician, future rock star, and even composer. And Tyler, whose work spans many decades as a musician, touring artist, rock legend, music producer, and film composer, and this rise has seen him work with some of the best, actually, including rock artists Bush, metal icon Jerry Cantrell, and film director James Gunn. He's the composer of the sensational scores to such huge Hollywood franchises as Guardians of the Galaxy, as Sean just highlighted, Fast and the Furious, and John Wick, and he's been enjoying well-deserved praise from horror fans too. His amazing music for Ty West's Twisted Trilogy, X, Pearl, and the upcoming Maxine. Sean and I spent over an hour with Tyler and Lola, and here, now fully uncut with everything kept in, is what they had to say on this, our very first episode of We're Gonna Need a Bigger Pod presents Scoreheads.
How goes the Grand Farewell Tour?
Coming to an end.
So it seems, so it seems. 42 regular, wasn't it? It's Kevlar front to back. The latest in ballistic chic. Appropriate for all formal occasions. Weddings, funerals, high table duels. After all, a man has to look his best when it's time to get married. Or buried.
It is now a great honour and a privilege for Sean and I to welcome onto this week's show two guests for you this week. One being the awesome composer of X, Pearl, and the upcoming Maxine, the incredible Mr. Tyler Bates. And for the first time on this very show, a musician, composer, and multi-instrumentalist that's been making waves with some amazing music and proving that exceptional talent definitely runs in this family. Tyler's daughter, the fantastic Lola Collette, joins us on the show too. Welcome to you both. How are you both doing?
We're good.
Yeah, we're
Thank
good.
Thank you for having us.
We're enjoying, I wouldn't call it that exactly, but we're off tour for about 48 hours. Both of us had some things we needed to knock out here in LA, so we fortunately had a 3-day break in the tour, and now we're here. We're sitting in my studio that's in disarray because it's in the midst of a renovation, but we're here with you and excited to talk about music.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us to talk about, well, pretty much all of the great work you've been doing of late. But I thought, Tyler, if you don't mind, actually, as it's Lola's first time with us, we would start with you, Lola, if that's okay, with your dad. As obviously, Tyler, we have your amazing story on record already. So, Lola, I thought we'd start with your journey as an artist and how things began for you as a musician. And how and when did you know you were going to essentially be getting into the family business? And was it your dad that inspired that?
Mm-hmm, totally. Well, started at 5 years old, and I was signed up for piano lessons. And I ended up staying with this teacher for around 13 years. She was she classically trained me as a pianist. So that's where my roots are. I also train with a vocalist and have been songwriting since about 14, just naturally came about. When I was about 15, I downloaded Pro Tools. It was my first DAW, and I've been using it ever since. And we've worked, co-produced songs together in the past, so I learned a lot of my skills from him, just being in the studio and being around him and his work. My first real gig as a recording musician was 12 years old. I was invited to record piano on the Guardians of the Galaxy score as solo pianist, and we recorded that at Capitol Records. And ever since I've been playing piano on scores, and in recent years, been working as a vocalist and doing a lot of ethereal vocal works for TV shows and movies, such as Girl in the Woods, which is a Peacock special that they were working on. And I've also worked on the John Wick movies and a couple other projects that they've had going on here in the studio. So they'll just invite me in whenever they need me, and I'll, you know, I'm easy. I record vocals and piano whenever and wherever is needed.
We work in triage mode here. So it's like, oh my God, we need this done in 20 minutes. I'll just like text Lola. I'm like, I'm going to send you a session. Can you just give me this thing here? And she does it and flips it back. And that's how some of it definitely goes. So the great thing is, over the years, she has developed a sensibility for what's appropriate and what's needed, because there's really not a lot of time to for me to explain everything. And sometimes it's up to interpretation and it requires experimentation. And fortunately, she seems to get it and teach me a little bit about music as a result.
Yeah, actually, I was going to ask about the dynamic that the two of you have when you're making music together. Is it an exchange of ideas that kind of goes backwards and forwards between the two of you, like, continuously?
Yeah, I would say so. There have been a lot of times in the past and currently where I'll bring songs to him and that I've written and produced demos for, and then we'll exchange ideas and then elevate those songs to the next level. And we're currently finishing up an EP of 5 songs that we've co-produced together that I'm really excited about. And it's a really exciting experience to be able to, and just intimate experience to be able to work with a family member. You can just be very vulnerable. And there are a lot of amazing notes and ways that he challenges me to bring the inner artist out. So that's been really awesome working on my music with him. And there are times when he'll be working with artists and needs me to step in and sing a vocal on a song, or just, you know, for movie scores and that kind of thing. And I'll step in and kind of give my 2 cents and interpret it in a way that makes sense for the film, but also still is integral to, you know, my artistry.
Tyler, you were just saying there about learning from each other, really. That was going to be my next question. Is obviously between a father and a daughter, there's many lessons you can teach about life and about music, but actually you were just remarking that you're actually teaching each other quite a lot of the time, you were saying.
Without a doubt. And if we look back in our early lives to our formative years where we're establishing or learning our fundamentals, we become skilled to the degree where we oftentimes abandon some of the fundamentals because we're on to other things, and we forget why that very simple thing works so well. It's everything doesn't have to be complex, and at the core of really great creative work, I think there are fundamentals that, of course, we sort of take them and twist them and create our own signature with them. But you know, on the earlier side of your career, you're not as informed or jaded from experience. And I'm not a jaded person. Like, I am still, like, every day super passionate and excited about music. And that's why I'm involved in so many different things. But the real payoff to the career is that you never stop learning. And I work with geniuses, like, all day long. The directors I work with, they're all geniuses. Like, every last one of them. And you can't help but elevate your game. And the artists I work with have their own creative genius. She does. Starcrawler does. Jerry Cantrell, amazing writer. Gavin Rossdale, amazing writer. And I've learned from all of them. And in turn, I also try and really set the table for people to believe in themselves and in their talent and in the moment that we're making what we're creating. You know, it's not about the success that was had in the past. It's about, we're here now, let's make the great stuff now. So there is a reciprocal aspect to it. Lola's natural ability with complex musical concepts is a lot, like, for me to take it all in, especially because she has such a fluid piano background and a classical music background and very deep into jazz as well. I have to continue to expand my vocabulary in order to keep up. So it's great. And even with the Starcrawler kids, they're all like 22 and younger. And there's something about the way they work that teaches me a lot about perspective that maybe isn't apparent in my life as I walk through my life. So it's definitely continuing to challenge me to grow, which I love. And I welcome that in my life.
Yeah, and I would say at the end of the day, it just comes from being passionate about music and about the history of music, really delving into what's been made before your time. And so I've just spent so many hours of my life listening to music and to vinyl and playing classical music. And I'm just so in love with all different types of music. And so I love to share that with my dad as well.
It's fascinating what you said that, Lola, about engaging with the history of music, because I often find some of the best conversations I've had with my parents are about music, when they pass something down generationally on to me. they almost like take great pride in the fact that I can listen to an artist. And it's like, oh yeah, because we introduced you to that. I don't know if you both thought that music is one of the great things that can kind of bond different like generations of like family members together creatively.
Totally. I think it's a universal language, and I don't think I would be my own artist if I didn't have all these other influences that kind of come out in my own music. Like, I understand what's been done and made before, and then I can take that and, you know, give my own voice to this whole world of music while also respecting what's come before me.
Mm-hmm. It's also interesting working in the studio together, obviously. Me technically being the father before we walk in the studio. There's certain things that, yeah, I mean, we're close and we are friends, but there's certain things that probably don't need to be said 100% literally out in the open, but you certainly learn a lot about another person's life when you're in the studio with them, especially through their lyrics and the way they convey the performance. And I'm thrilled that we, you know, Lola has enough trust in me to allow me into that space with her, and I trust her. I mean, the reason I've hired her on scores is I am ethically obligated to create the best product. Mm-hmm. And I know, like with the piano work on Guardians of the Galaxy, she's always had this delicate touch. She was in the orchestra at Abbey Road when she was 15 on the second one with 92 players. I mean, that is pressure. And I was watching this go down and I'm like, why didn't I ever put myself in the orchestra, like just with some of the guitar work? And then I thought, because it's too scary.
Oh, yeah.
I'll do it afterwards.
Scariest day of my life.
Yeah, I had one of those.
I think the first time we spoke actually was about Guardians Volunteer. It's a beautiful score. I still revisit it very often. It's incredible, incredible. And how did you feel, Lola, coming away from that experience at Abbey Road and, you know, a movie that size? How was it for you?
It was life-changing. It definitely helps you work under pressure. I remember there was a moment where, you know, you have a screen that tells you the clicks, and then you have the conductor, and the conductor was off by one beat, and I decided I'm gonna follow the screen instead of the conductor when the entire orchestra did the opposite for me. And I remember all like 33 violinists just turning around and being like, oh, what's going on back there? So it was definitely a challenge and very scary, but I was very proud of myself afterward, and I felt like I performed well.
As I understand it, for John Wick 4, both of you have produced a punk rock cover of Nowhere to Run by Martha and the Vandellas, if that's right. I mean, that's a huge undertaking in and of itself. It's such a famous piece of music. I wonder if you could talk us through like the nature of that collaboration and how you alighted on that.
That was like it was inadvertently set up. Okay, so at the time, this was about a year ago, I was on tour with Jerry Cantrell, and Jerry and Lola have their own friendship. She sang on his current solo record, Brighton. So Jerry, he didn't ask me about it. He just went to Lola, asked her to be the opening act on the tour. So she was out with her band with us. And then the music supervisor emailed me and said, look, we really want you to go in and demo out these two songs so we can determine, you know, how they feel in the context of John Wick. They didn't want to just use the originals. They wanted to feel something in like the John Wick mode, right? So coincidentally, 2 days later, we had a day off in New York. My closest friend from here actually built a studio out in New York, and he happened to be working there. I just called him because I talked to him every day anyway. I'm like, dude, are you going to be in New York? He's like, yeah, I'm there now. And I said, can we slip in there for half a day? And he said, sure. The band that he's working with, they said that they would be happy to step aside for us to come in and do our work. And actually, a couple of the guys sat in on the first draft of Nowhere to Run because we had to put together enough musicians. So I grabbed a couple people from the band. I'm like, Lola, you ever hear this song? And she was like, no, but I'll listen to it. I'm like, I need a guide vocal just to send them what this feels like. So the next day we went and cut it. She stood in the room with the live band, drums, everything, and just sang into a mic. And I sent that to Chad Stahelski. And Chad popped it into the cut of the movie, and it just sat there for like 6 months. And then it came time where we needed to finalize the songs. And so he had asked me originally at the very onset of the project if I heard of In This Moment, because he really loves Maria Brink, you know. And I was working on a record with them at the time, and also their new record. So he asked if we could get them to do something. I'll make sure, because they're big fans of John Wick. But then when it came time to address Nowhere to Run, I was thinking, well, that would be where Maria would sing, I guess, on a cover song. He said, who's singing? That's Junior, right? I'm like, you mean Lola? And he says, yeah. He says, I like her. Have her just throw herself into it. I think she's great. So that came about that way. Maria heard Lola's version and she says, I can't touch that, you know. I'm better to do my own thing. And she's such an amazing singer and an incredible human. I thought that was such an amazing gesture, knowing how excited she was to be part of John Wick, and then it looked like it wasn't going to happen. And Chad had heard the song that we have in the movie, I Will Die For You. He had heard it right after he had initially contacted me about In This Moment, because we had just written the song. And we played this song again. He's like, can we please have this song in the movie? This is so good, because he's such a fan. So it really worked out in the best of all scenarios, because Lola was just doing me a favor, because I needed to provide them a quick demo of the song just to get away from the original. And it just turned out that they really liked her a lot. So
my next question would be, Lola, how are you feeling about being part of the John Wick universe?
I'm super excited about it, and I can't wait to see the final cut of the movie and see how the song plays, you know, against the scene, because I have no idea what it's going to look like yet, so I'm really excited about that. And it was such a fun process. We went to East West Studios here in Hollywood, and I was recording for the day with my band on my own music, and we decided to slip Nowhere to Run in there and get the final cut of it. Took my shoes off and just like really got in the flow and just gave it as much energy I possibly could. And I'm very proud of it. So I'm excited that it's in that movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you're hearing in the movie is probably 90% the second take that she did. And then the 10% would have been pulled from the first. So it was like, it's a performance. It's not manufactured. So it's pretty cool that it just went down that way, because obviously Lola was really focused on getting her record done. And she's like, all right, let's do Nowhere to Run. So we just knocked it out. And I thought that was pretty cool. And it was so spirited because we didn't labor over it too much. You know, sometimes you can labor over something too much and there's not enough spontaneity in the performance. And so I think it's pretty fiery. It's cool.
Well, it sounds like the go for broke attitude that you both applied to that is embodied in the series, isn't it? Because John Wick is very kind of the idea of putting that a new twist on existing tropes, on existing things with which we're familiar, which is something that the John Wick, that Tyler, you've done in your John Wick music, which happens in the John Wick films, that they turn these conventions inside out. I imagine that must be a really exhilarating process to be able to do that, to be able to turn our expectations around like that.
Yeah, I mean, and the movie calls on a different aesthetic with the songs as we've gone through them. It's been rooted a little bit more in like rock or active rock type music for the first three. But because this movie, it's so huge. I mean, it's so huge. There's so much music in this movie. It's insane. But there are some electronic artists that are featured in this one, besides the Castlevania, who is a very, very good friend of mine, and he's been involved, you know, from the get-go with us. So I was thinking about it, you know, we needed a slightly different approach to the songs that I was producing for the film. And instead of really being ensconced in like hard rock or metal, I thought maybe a little bit more of a garagey punk take on these songs would blend a little bit better with the story and with the licensed music as well. It was a lot of fun to do it. And some of the stuff, you know, we're kind of taking that style and juxtaposing that with the orchestral arrangements, and made it a lot of fun to create those songs for the film.
Working with Chad, I know you love to work with Chad, and it's very clear that you guys are friends and you have a very clear understanding of each other's artistry. We're looking at the John Wick films. I think I said this to you before, like they are bullet ballets, as I like to call them, in that there's so much work on and off camera that goes into them. They are art. They're not just your average, ordinary, everyday action movie. There's the choreography and how everything is shot. It's beautiful artistry. How do you find as a composer having to come at that, you know, in terms of how it is like a big dance, isn't it, I guess, John Wick? And how do you come to that as a composer and kind of get that magic right when in terms of timing? Because timing is so important in the movies as well, isn't it?
Yeah, and you really have to feel the flow of the entirety of what's going on. It just can't be tagging every shot or every action. Mm-hmm. There is a certain, as you mentioned, almost like a balletic flow to the sequence. Mm-hmm. Chad Stahelski is a master in multiple martial arts. He's cultured in it. Kung Fu movies and Westerns are his favorite. This movie has so many heavy martial artists that are legendary throughout the world. I think it's going to really please a lot of people. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, I have to look at the flow of the movie and the arc of the story. And the sound of John Wick just wouldn't be what it is had it not been for the collab between Joel Richard and I. Joel is a huge contributor to the sound. He's like a brother to me. And the beauty of John Wick is that it started as an indie film, right? It wasn't an existing property. It wasn't like there was already a comic book made of it or a graphic novel.
Yeah.
So nobody was really looking. Like, the expectations, I think, were low. The budget was low. And when Joel and I came on board, it was right when I was finishing the first Guardians of the Galaxy film. This was the first film for Chad Stahelski and David Leitch, especially working in tandem. I recognized them because they were in 300. They did all the stunt coordinating, and they were Spartans in that movie. So I'd been seeing them as in the Spartans for a year. But anyway, because they hadn't done it before, they kind of acquiesced to Joel and I and our music supervisor and music editor, Brian Richards, who is no longer with us in this world, but he was an amazing, amazing talent and great spirit. And he's still in John Wick. Like, he's a part of it. One of the greatest music editors ever and a true brother to Joel and I. So I think the collaboration between us really helped John Wick, or really was why John Wick became what it is now. And it's been a terrific experience for Joel and I to remain connected artistically because we've been friends so long, and to build on each other's ideas. And so it's been fun. This one was so crazy that there was, again, a lot of triage and needing to get things done fast. And Joel called on Lola a number of times to do some ambient vocal work, like ethereal stuff. And luckily she was there and available and able to record herself, because we just didn't have time to have her in the studio. There's too much to do. So it was kind of great all in all. And it seems like Lola understood the point of what we were looking for. So
I also study with a vocal coach who was on Broadway back in the day, and over the past couple years, she has helped me to access all different types of vowels and notes in my range that I never would have even imagined were there. And she's really kind of molded me into like a switchblade singer, so I can kind of step into any sort of situation and be able to give a piece of music the right tone. And so just even working with scores here in the studio has been like amazing for my own artistry, to understand how to utilize my vocals in all sorts of different ways. So that's been really awesome how it's in tandem with each other.
The use of vocals in John Wick, that really intrigues me. Is that a sense of, are you giving voice to his like inner torment? Because he is a very, very tormented character. He's a very driven character, but he is a human being at the end of the day. So I suppose the use of human voices in line with this character is an interesting proposition in a way.
Yeah, I mean, his deceased wife, Helen, is at the core of his motivation. I mean, it's whether she is the direct impetus for his response or desire for retribution is to be interpreted.
Subject for debate.
But his love for her was the most pure thing he possessed in life, or that he experienced in life, rather. And I think that that's why we love like the ethereal solo vocals. It at least helps imbue the moment with her spirit. Mm-hmm. That's at least the thinking and feeling behind it. And that's the role, I guess, you know, Lola is probably, I don't know if you're reading into that too deeply or not, but the emotion is there.
Mm-hmm. And I pick up on the cues from the music as well, and I let the music inspire me. And most of the time, I don't have a set of notes that I'm singing. I'll just show up and listen to the music once and then improvise over it. And I usually try and bring sort of a ghostly, ethereal vibe to it anyway, because it feels right with what they're working on.
You come here thinking there is a way out of this world for you, Mr. Wick. There is not. The Centre Pompidou.
Sacré-Cœur. Sacré-Cœur. Weapons.
If you win, the table will honor its word. You will have your freedom. But you won't take it. Blades.
Pistols. Dueling pistols. 30 paces. In the event that both parties survive, each will approach the other at increments of 10 paces until only one remains.
And I know that obviously the movie opens on the 24th of March, and a lot of people are incredibly excited for this, including myself. I am so hyped for another John Wick. I just wish these could go on forever. They're so great. But as someone that's spent a lot of time, I guess, with the movie, Tyler, what can we expect, without spoilers, obviously, but what can we expect from John Wick 4?
Honestly, if you took three John Wicks and then just blew it up like popcorn, I mean, it's crazy the attention to detail in this. I remember reading the script to this movie, and I had to have Google open the whole time to keep looking up weapons, like just stuff I had no idea what it was. I think it's really remarkable. I mean, this movie is completely international. There are some characters that you love. There are new characters. There's so many masters of their craft in this film. It's nonstop entertainment. Visually, it's stunningly gorgeous, just strikingly gorgeous. And Keanu's as good as ever. I can't imagine somebody wouldn't be completely thrilled by seeing this movie, especially if you've enjoyed any of the John Wick films.
Yeah, the scope of this one looks enormous. Like you said, they're just completely, like you say, international. And there's a lovely shot. I don't know, it's in the trailer. I don't know if it's Japan or it might be the scene in Paris. It's got like a burnished look. So it looks absolutely staggering. I imagine that must provide a huge amount of musical inspiration when you can see the director, the filmmakers actually gaining in confidence with their own aesthetic, right?
Yeah, I'm waiting for, so let's see what happens after this movie comes out, because there's got to be somebody who does a John Wick 4 travelogue. One person in this world might do it, where they do the full John Wick 4 travelogue. But there's so much to see in this movie, so many aspects of various cultures that are introduced in a graphic novel kind of context. So let's not get too crazy for how literal we're supposed to interpret everything. But it's really an amazing look into so many aspects of the world and in historical architecture and martial arts, of course. And I don't want to say too much, but it's amazing.
And you've done a great work, as I say, on all three films, and I have no doubt this fourth soundtrack is going to be amazing too. What did you guys do differently? Obviously, John has his theme, and there are themes within the series that obviously must continue, and you build upon those. But what's new about the music of John Wick 4, aside from obviously the points we've covered about some great songs and so forth?
Well, there are definitely a number of new themes. We did employ an orchestra on this one for some of the music, but it's the interesting thing about the music of John Wick, especially the way it works with the picture, it's almost like a John Carpenter movie. So if you've written music for any movie like that, you'll see that the picture really kicks back to you all the things that just don't work immediately. Like a Halloween movie, like when I did the first Halloween film with Rob Zombie, we thought we were going to just go do our own thing. And once we got into it, we realized that music is kind of a fundamental component to how the movie itself works. So we found some of those aspects really becoming apparent in this movie more than all of them. So the use of the orchestra was more of a support element to add some depth to the sounds that we already created, but not to supplant all the experimental stuff that Joel and I do with synthesizers and sound design. It's still very rock and roll, but Joel definitely developed a few really great psychological and emotional themes for this film that I think are really strong, and Lola sang on his stuff. Most of what I have done in this movie is action-oriented music, and played a lot of guitar and bass and guitar viol and synthesizers and stuff. But again, it's such an enormous collaboration between Joel and I. I'd say both of our contribution would serve a complete movie, each independent of one another, and then we cross-pollinate all of our work. So anything that I do, I send to Joel, and he'll kind of put his thumbprint into it, and vice versa. So it's been a really awesome collaboration over the years.
How goes the Grand Farewell Tour?
Coming to an end.
So it seems, so it seems. 42 regular, wasn't it? It's Kevlar front to back. The latest in ballistic chic. Appropriate for all formal occasions. Weddings, funerals, high table duels. After all, a man has to look his best when it's time to get married. Or buried.
So excited. So excited.
And again, it stems from being an indie movie, man. Like, I mean, there's almost nothing that becomes a franchise like this starting from nothing. Really, I mean, I'm not saying nothing, but not a big studio, not a big budget. This is just a vision, a dream that Chad and Dave had on the first one, and it's grown into this whole franchise. And Keanu has been spectacular. Obviously, he's very much involved with what the movies are. He's a producer, and he knows what he's doing. But just excellent people. It's been really great to be involved with them.
I think the first one, they all are, but the first one's definitely one of like my favorite action movies ever. Just blew me away. It's so amazing.
I'm worried there may be something real wrong with me.
Rumor has it they only take one gal or town.
We're looking for someone with X Factor.
It has to be me.
How about a film nobody else has seen?
Is it legal?
It will be eventually.
I wondered if I might move on to another thing that we're all really excited about, me particularly, is Pearl, which I saw just recently, and I was like, oh wow, like chef's kiss as far as the music and the aesthetic of the movies. It's so brilliant, and clearly it's a prequel to X, which was a really, really fascinating collaboration between yourself and Ty West. You've now picked up this collaboration on Pearl, and because this throws the story back to the early 20th century, the aesthetic of the score and as the aesthetic of the movie is completely different, and it's fascinating. And I wondered, but this is a fascinating prospect, like, did you and Ty West kind of have this idea, did you decide on this idea like early on, like what was the process with this in terms of deciding the music?
Well, first off, Pearl came around so quickly because he shot it sequentially with X. It was he and Mia Goth wrote Pearl when they were prepping X over in New Zealand over COVID. And A24 greenlit them to shoot this movie sequentially. And Ty is also an editor, so the guy's a beast. He's such an incredible talent. So we got X done, and then he had a locked picture for Pearl, which locked picture almost never occurs these days. The movie is constantly evolving, and we as composers are constantly trying to fit the pants on the running man, so to speak, right? But at any rate, Ty came to me about Pearl, and he's like, dude, we need this like in a matter of weeks. And he says, I'm thinking of this style, and that golden era Hollywood composing is really what I noticed first about film music that I liked. I never imagined I was going to score movies in life. It just sort of happened. And my good friend Tim Williams, who's worked with me on the vast majority of my films in some capacity, And he's a very close friend. He too has a deep cultural affinity for that music. So when Ty mentioned it to me, I'm like, dude, the only way we're going to get this done is if I have Tim as my partner and maybe one other person. I said, because this music's very detailed and it's all live. I mean, you know, we couldn't do this with samples. So there was a lot of music prep involved with this, and we recorded in Nashville, which they were great, but it's just, it's a different challenge than recording in Los Angeles or in London. Tim did an amazing job orchestrating and conducting the score. But again, it was just wonderful to be in the process. Ty knows exactly what he's looking for. And in a movie like X, per se, he could be satisfied a thousand different ways, but he knows what he wants the feeling to be and the overall aesthetic to be. So he's not giving me any dictation. There's no temp score or anything like that. It's all conversational between us. And with Pearl, it was a little bit more determined what we were going to do and how we were going to go about it, because there just wasn't time for conceptual experimentation. But I think he always knew he wanted to approach it from that golden era of Hollywood music, which is not a literal expression from 1918, 1919, as Pearl takes place. But I think it was a great call. It was a wonderful opportunity to write very thematic material, overly dramatic material, to factor into sort of the interesting duality of this movie. There's a little bit of a wink in this film, and we were able to work that into the music. Really proud to be part of it. And again, another movie with Ty, and Tim, you know, is one of my dearest friends. So it was a wonderful collaboration. Greg Preckel helped us a bit too. And Ty and I have established a great rapport, because we started with The Sacrament back in like 2014 or 2013 was our first experience together. And I'm excited for the next one.
Because with Pearl, the music, like the film, there is a sense that it's pastiche, but it's sincere pastiche. Like, you are actually, the music actually does invest you in the head of this character played by Mia Goth. You do end up, you know, understanding her journey and sympathizing with her up to a point. And I love the way, like you said there, the music kind of like winks, and yet it is also a very serious sort of evocation of what that era of film music sounded like. I mean, I was thinking of maybe Max Steiner by way of Bernard Herrmann. Those are just two things that kind of came to mind. I don't know if there are any specific reference points for it. That's what leapt to my mind.
Well, Bernard Herrmann was communicating in such a distinct language and with such grand gestures at times. Same with Max Steiner, and Franz Waxman back then was doing crazy things as well that I always found fascinating. You know, before I even began to understand any of the technical aspects of music, I was fascinated by how somebody could compose such insane music. Without a doubt, that stuff is imbued in both Tim and I, and it was fun to have the opportunity to express that. You know, there were, like on the Watchmen film, I got to do kind of imbibe in a little bit of the yesteryear, you know, and kind of genre bend a little bit. So I would say that was great fun, and I'm looking forward to what's up in front of me right now.
Let's talk about your relationship with Ty, actually, because you guys obviously get on amazingly well. You're looking at, what, four movies? And when you include Maxine, I guess that's what, your fourth? Maxine will be your fourth title together, is that right?
Or So long as he doesn't fire me, yeah.
what is it about working with Ty? You guys clearly have a great shorthand. You get on very well. What is it for you about working with Ty, and what's it like working with Ty?
Well, for one, he's brilliant, and he's not the kind of person who's going to act like he's brilliant. He just is. He's a very take action kind of person, so he's an excellent editor. And really, of all the movies I've done, his style of editing is up there with the absolute best of them. He has a great command over what he has to say, and he's very good at communicating his ideas. He definitely knows music, but he is so smart and aware about how he communicates with the composer that he doesn't box us into a corner by giving us literal music references to have to interpret. There's something very, very specific, you already start limiting your options creatively because you think you have to, you know, come very close to someone else's idea. And
yeah,
we talk about things not literally in the picture, but we play each other music and have conversations about things that we love. And even if it has nothing to do with the movie, we understand one another's sensibilities greater from having those conversations. But I know, like, Ty respects his characters tremendously. And in a lot of horror movies, we can't wait till they start killing everybody because they're all characters. We're already just, you know, kind of spiting them or laughing at them because they're not usually the highest caliber people. But in Ty's movies, he's letting us into, like, their personal journeys, their dreams, their aspirations, their struggles, their self-doubt, you know, all that dialogue. And Pearl, her dialogue is all about trying to confirm herself because she doesn't have any belief in herself because it's been completely beaten out of her. You know, and a lot of people in life experience that. They feel like even by the time they enter their young adult life that their aspirations have been shot down, so they don't pursue them because they don't feel that they deserve the opportunity to pursue them. I think if you think about those sort of things and the way Ty is depicting his characters, he's showing you that they're all going through that, and he respects that journey, and we don't ever want to with music create impressions of emotions. Like, we're invested in the characters, so regardless of how abstract the music is, the emotion is true. The emotion is coming from a place of, like, being soulful, not like I'm into torture porn movies and run someone's head over with a pickup truck, so let's score that. We're scoring the character aspect of it. The visuals tell the story. The sound design tells that story. I don't need to triple down on somebody being, you know, mutilated or something. You know, I mean, it's silly. So what we do is we try and represent the heart and soul of the characters involved on both sides of the equation, because there is a place where each of these people started with no marks on their record in life, and somehow they're now at these places. I think that's something that, for me, would be really exciting to see the consciousness of society to consider that more and more. You know, what is the backstory behind this person, this villain, this horrible person now? I mean, Pearl seems horrible, but I feel for her in that film, and certainly in X. I mean, Maxine, you can't help but sympathize with some of her experience. She doing cocaine is not like The Hangover or something. This is like, it's kind of tragic. You know, you can tell she's on a trajectory that's going to lead to a dark place, and we don't want her to go there. You know, we're rooting for her to get through it. You know, we're not hoping she's going to not make it through this film. We want her to survive, you know, and I think that in part, you know, in a huge part is to tie his writing, his directing, and what he underscores or expresses to me is so important about the characters and about the story itself. So it's real easy to chalk it up to like X being like, oh, it's some throwback horror movie. It's totally not. It's a character piece. And if you really pay attention, there's something that all of us grapple with in life that's going on with each of those characters. So that's really why I enjoy these movies so much, because he knows exactly what his story is about. And that more aptly, you know, gives me, you know, all the information that I need to go on and to experiment, instead of being so worried that I'm going to miss the point and he's going to freak out because he doesn't understand music and just thinks I can't write music. He's like, hey man, try it, just go for it, you know. And I trust him enough to know that if it doesn't land, that he's not going to sack me. We'll just try again.
He sounds so cool. He's a genius.
Yep. I'm really, really grateful to have the opportunity to continue working with him. So I'm going to do my best.
Lola, to bring you back into the conversation, I wondered, Tyler, when you're working on a score like Pearl, like, if you're having sketches, like, would you like present like a rough idea of a sketch like Tallulah to get like another perspective on like how a theme might work or how it might develop or something?
Well, if I'm writing a piece of music, I mean, anyone who's written anything understands that as soon as they invite someone else to listen to what they're doing in the same room, things become apparent in your mind. And then when it's somebody that you respect their overall sensibilities and musicality, it amplifies that aspect. So yeah, Lola's a sounding board for me sometime because she's my daughter, but she's my friend and she's an artist I respect a lot. So there is that aspect. But like, say we did the show Girl in the Woods, and it seemed very obvious to me that we needed to have a female vocal involved in the music. And I wrote something that is, I don't know why it turned out this way. Maybe because it's the way the visuals were cut, but it's in odd time signatures and it's kind of changing a lot. And I asked Lola if she could do something thematically that will sort of glue all that together so that as the audience is taking it in, they're not aware that the timing changes are happening or the meter changes are happening. I just wanted it to play as music. And so that was the test that I gave to her, and she did her work.
Yeah, definitely. And I feel like there are many times where I'll come up into the studio, and just because he's passionate about a song or a track that he's working on with an artist, he'll just be like, hey, what are you thinking about this? And do you maybe have any ideas of a synth line that could go here or a sound that you want to hear in this song? And so I always have a really fun time listening to whatever he's working on and giving my two cents if I can. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lola has a studio here at the place where we all work. So fortunately, she's an accessible resource much of the time. But it is cool to be, I do have a handful of people that are great colorists that I can literally just send a Pro Tools session to. And we've worked together so much that we communicate in a shorthand. It's always exciting to hear those performances and see how it's impacting the picture and how it inspires me to take that piece of music to the next stage. You know, Lola just happened to become one of the people that I work with a lot. I love working with Gil Sharon. He's not the only drummer percussionist I work with. I mean, I've done a ton with Greg Ellis, but Vincent Jones, who's an excellent composer in his own right, has been gracious enough to do some of these color sessions. Roger Manning Jr., I mean, another incredible artist. This is part of what I love about doing this. I'm inspired by the talent and the craft of other people as much as I am challenging myself. And I think being inspired by other people is part of what challenges me to be better. So you form bonds with people because they're part of that equation. You know, you love those people because you know that you're becoming a more accomplished artist and you're growing as a human being just from the interactions you're having with them. So I know that's getting kind of philosophical about things, but that's really a really powerful aspect of how I view my work.
And you're lifting each other up as well, you know, and it's sharing that energy and that creative energy, and everything goes in this kind of real nice, poetic, artistic flow. I think it's certainly a beautiful thing. And actually, you were just talking about working together. Of course, you're producing records with Lola yourself as well, away from the film space, aren't you? You guys are working on music together.
For sure. Just having a musical parent has really given me the foundation to believe in myself as a musician and an artist. So whenever I write a song, I get excited about it if I think it's good, and I'll send it to him. And when he becomes excited about a song that I'm working on, that's amazing. And when we can get in the studio together and work on it, and I really value being challenged. And there are certain parts and vocal arrangements and things that I hadn't had in those songs. And he would be like, you know, this song could really be elevated by a harsh piano performance or anything in that realm. So it's been really fun working on this body of work together. It's five songs that I've written. It's all original music, and I play a lot of the instruments, and I do all the singing on the songs, and I have two friends that are in a band called White Reaper. They're amazing drummer and bass players, and they recorded on the entirety of the project as well. So it's just been a fun experience to like have my friends involved as well as working with my dad, and it's just come together beautifully.
And that's coming out soon, I guess?
Yeah, so I mean, the John Wick movie's coming out, and Nowhere to Run is a really exciting catalyst for just my career as an artist. So I want to capitalize on that and start releasing music soon after. So, you know, my plan is to release a single. I've got accompanying videos along with the songs in the EP, and by the end of the year, the EP will be out.
I just wanted to return just to the point of the idea of those colouring sessions, like the idea of that I find that really, really interesting, the idea that you get the germ of a musical idea and then other people's perspectives can kind of colour it out. I wondered, Lola, do you remember having like a particularly visceral reaction to one of Tyler's like sort of works in progress, or like, you know, there was a theme that was being worked out that you remember reacting like strongly to in the early stages?
For sure. Well, the studio asked me to work on a large project, and at the time I was living in Nashville going to school at Belmont University out there, and I had my whole rig set up and everything, and they asked me to do a lot of just improvised vocals over all these different sessions that made up the new Disney World attraction, the Guardians of the Galaxy Cosmic Rewind in the Epcot part of Disney World. And so I had about like 20-30 minutes of music just to completely improvise over. And I didn't necessarily know. They just kind of said, you know, do your thing and apply your artistry to this and just, you know, improvise over what's there. And there were moments where I really felt like my artistry was being represented in that project, and I'm really excited to know that my voice is forever on that ride in Disney World. Yeah. So that was a really awesome project to be a part of, definitely.
I wanted to ask you about the series, the Netflix series that's coming out, Agent Elvis, which sounds absolutely insane. An adult animated series that features Matthew McConaughey voicing a superhero version of Elvis Presley. Please tell me more about this. It sounds awesome.
Everybody's in that show. It's crazy. Like, actually, week after week, Tim and I were realizing that there were different, you know, more and more and more interesting actors involved in it. And it's a laundry list of great actors. I don't want to say too much about it because I don't know what y'all have seen in the trailer that was released. So I'm trying not to let the cat out of the bag. It's so funny and naturally edgy. And the cool thing about it is, like, John Eddie Cummings, who is the engine behind the creative work on, you know, the writing of Agent Elvis, he's a career musician. And I think having had that experience and having toured opening for, I think he was touring with Lisa Marie Presley at one time, opening for her. And just having a window just to look into the idea of Elvis with a close proximity like that. I imagine there were probably many stories exchanged between them. But his voice as a musician behind all of this, I think, really makes it so much better, because he was truly able to give Tim and I free rein to really just dream up whatever we thought was appropriate for the show. And then he could really engage in that conversation in a constructive fashion. And frankly, everybody at Netflix was great, too. I really enjoyed working with everyone. It was one of the really positive feeling projects that I worked on coming out of COVID. So, you know, we were certainly grateful to have that to focus on. And again, you know, Tim and I being able to work on the score was amazing. You know, he's my brother. So it's like, how much better does it get when you're working really hard on something that you love, and to be able to share it with somebody else that you admire and respect a lot? It's great. It was cool to be able to call on Lola to do a little vocal work for us when we needed it. And again, that was all happening so fast. It was like, hey, can you get this to me by 2 o'clock? Yeah, I know it's 1:15 now, but can you get it to me by 2 o'clock? So there's a little bit of that going on, but it was all in a very positive spirit. Everybody was so cool. My takeaway from that is hugely positive, and I think it's massively entertaining. I mean, there's just no way to watch that show and not laugh, and I'm pretty tough. Like, it takes a lot for me to laugh, so, yeah.
Did your dad tell you that you, when you were going through, like, you were saying, oh, I need it in 45 minutes or whatever, did your dad tell you at any point that it was for an animated superhero version of Elvis, and how did you respond to that?
Yeah, they did explain to me the premise of the show, and I thought it was so much fun. I'm like, hell yeah, I'll be a part of that. Yeah.
<Amazing. laughs> Well, the musical potential, I imagine, in when you've got Elvis Presley as a main character, right, that must just open so many doors to creative possibilities, just to be funny and be surreal. That must just be so much fun, I imagine.
Oh yeah, we're referential without a doubt to the era, and it's fun just to get my acid rock guitar sounds and, you know, just my other rock guitar sounds of the era and to play into music like that. And Tim and I, our specialties, let's say, we complement each other very well, and it was so much fun to collaborate with him on it. It was one of the closest knit collaborations I've had on TV show or a movie in quite some time. I mean, Joel and I on John Wick we've known each other forever, but for John Wick's into it, I think we've sort of become shorthand in the way that we do it, so we're not as conscious about it. But Agent Elvis was such a new thing for both Tim and I, and a unique opportunity that it really was like something that commanded our complete attention, and we had a lot of fun, had a lot of laughs throughout. Still just marveling in the show. And it's so cool to be working on something episodic, especially, and you become a fan of the show as you approach your work. It's not like with a movie, you'll go back and forth throughout the movie, however kajillion many times, you know, as the picture evolves. But with this, it's episodic. So you get into it and you don't even know what's going to happen next in the next episode. You might get a clue, but, you know, it makes it that much more fun when you're working with somebody, just to have that ongoing dialogue with them. A movie is great, but it's a different type of medium. So all I can take away, you know, mostly from this is that it was really a great show. The people were awesome, and Tim and I had a blast.
So it's a really, really good time to be a Tyler Bates fan right now, because here in the UK, Pearl doesn't open until the 17th of March. In theatres. It's still not in theatres here yet. And then a week later, we get John Wick 4. And I think around that time, we also get Elvis as well, right? All at the same time over here. So it's a good time to be collecting your records.
Well, I'm grateful for the opportunity to work with so many geniuses, and for them to trust me with the task of doing their scores. And it's great to continue to grow as a person. You know, a lot of people might not be looking for as many personal challenges in life as they become more experienced. But to me, it's what keeps me, keeps my fire. And I'm just so excited to be involved in everything I'm doing right now. So very appreciative.
Yeah, on a personal note for me, I just wanted to say, there's one particular track that you did from the first Guardians of the Galaxy that I wanted to say thanks for, because it's so beautiful, which is the Groot Spores track. It's just gorgeous. I think it's only about a minute and a half, and it's so emotive. I remember watching the film for the first time thinking, wow, that's just, you've invested me in the emotional journey of a humanoid tree that can only speak three words, and it worked.
Well, it was, you know, from the get-go on Guardians, we had discussed really treating all the characters as like we would humans, and respecting them in the same way. And so even though that particular piece of music is very fantastical, it's still rooted in authentic emotion. You know, for me, I don't like seeing a movie and feeling an impression of an emotion. It's got to be authentic regardless what the context is. So I'm glad that you know, the idea of doing something fantastical but rooting it in real human emotion was available to me to explore. And that was part of a really great collab with James Gunn.
You know mine already. We talked about mine. Mine's Dad from Volume 2. Just I love it. It kills me, but I love it so much.
That was cool. There were a lot of really special moments on that one, too. There was a whole segment of that movie that was unscored for a long time because they kept working on the picture and visual effects. And what was it called? The one where Peter Quill's dad, like, touches him on the forehead and laser beams shoot out his eyes. And there's that whole sequence of him having that connection with his father, but also, you know, understanding his father's a villain and all that. You know, it was just kind of that was a moment in the movie that I was just continually told, yeah, just hold off. We're not ready. So one day we had a meeting to review some music I'd written on the Marvel campus. And I told the music editor, I said, look, if the meeting goes well, I'm going to have brought some equipment with me today. And I'm going to just try and hold them for an extra 5-10 minutes because I'm going to play live to picture because we got to get into this piece of music. So I brought my guitar, viol, and a loop station, a couple delays, and the meeting went really well. And I said, hey, can you guys just hang for 5 minutes? And they're like, yeah, what's up? And then I asked the music editor to bring up that sequence. And so he did. And I just plugged in and built that piece of music live, just improvised, and the music editor recorded it on his phone, so he gave me that recording at least, and then they loved it. So literally the phone recording of that piece of music was transcribed to be exactly what's in the movie, so it was pretty for me that was a really awesome moment.
Very awesome indeed. Guys, we're out of time. Everybody, thank you so much. Tyler, to Lola, Sean, thanks for joining us. This has been a brilliant conversation. We've learned a lot and really appreciate your time. Good luck with the tour. Good luck with all your new music. Good luck with all the movies you have coming out, the shows. It seems like a really exciting time for you both, and wishing you every success, and thank you again.
All right, John and Sean, thank you for having us today. And
great to meet you guys.
Thank you. Bye. Many try, many die. Get it
bloody. Step up on your ego.
Come on.
The only way John Wick will ever have freedom and peace is in death.
Yeah, not really.
And there we have it, the amazing Tyler Bates and Lola Collette, who we caught up with a couple of weeks ago to discuss all their brilliant work on some fantastic projects, which I will recap for you in a second. Sean, how are you feeling, mate, now that's out in the open?
So thrilled to have spoken to both Tyler and Lola. They were both so generous with the anecdotes and with the process behind, you know, their own collaborations and their own individual projects. It's always really fascinating to talk to artists about that when you get to peek behind the curtain and you hear it directly from within the industry itself. Yeah, couldn't have been happy with that. And I do want to pinpoint Tyler's score for Pearl, which is just superb. It's just recent. The film has just recently been released in the UK, and it's a terrific film made all the better by Tyler and Tim Williams' score. I mean, that in particular, I think, grabs a place in my heart, I think.
That score is available now, of course, or as is the score for X. Very much looking forward to what he does with Maxine as well, as I imagine that will be a different aesthetic. Also, just to recap some of the projects we talked about, his work on Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 and 2 is, of course, still out in the world. It's available via Disney Music. Also, John Wick Chapter 4, that is out now via Lakeshore Records. Do go and check that out because that's very, very good. His music for Agent Elvis, which we also covered, is out now via Sony Classical. And is there anything else I missed there? I think we pretty much capped everything there. But the soundtracks are there and they're out in the world, so do go and see them. Of course, if you want to see anything that we discussed, Pearl is in cinemas now in the UK. Please do go and check it out. I think it's already headed to Blu-ray in the United States. However you may do so, do seek it out. It's a great film. Also, John Wick Chapter 4 is in cinemas and the theatres everywhere right now. And Agent Elvis is available now on Netflix. No, it's not for you to watch with your children. Just going to put that out there now. But it is a great show.
Also, I think it's worth pointing out, John Wick 4, not one to watch with the kids either. It's absolutely awesome. But,
I wouldn't watch Pearl with the kids either. Or X, for that matter.
But I'm waiting for a John Wick scene in which, you know, like a musical instrument is used as a killer device. I haven't quite got to that point yet. That would be amazing. Or like a vinyl or something, or a stylus.
Might work. That might work. But yes, by all means, check out, as I say, those movies are in cinemas now. All the soundtracks are out now on digital. There's some nice vinyl pieces available as well for some of the older scores of Tyler's. I know, because I own one of them, for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Beautiful piece. But yes, it's a great time to be a Tyler Bates fan, so by all means, check them out. Follow them online, Tyler Bates, Lola Collette. They're both on all the social media platforms as well. Thank you again to Tyler and to Lola, and also to Peter and all of the wonderful team at 2B Entertainment, who are champions and have been absolutely brilliant in helping us, not just this episode, but future episodes to come, which we'll tell you more about nearer the time. But thank you, yes, to Peter and Jenny and all of the, and Bobby and all of the great team there as well for their support with this. As I will say also to Lakeshore Records and anyone and everyone, Batlot Music and anyone and everyone that got involved, and Disney as well, actually. But yes, thank you to them too for all of their support with this episode. Thank you to you for listening at home. Thank you to you, Sean, for joining me for our pilot. I hope it went well. Do let us know. We are in the process of setting up the Scoreheads correspondence page, for want of a better description, and how you can reach out to us on social media. In the meanwhile, though, if you do want to reach out and tell us what you thought of the show, good, bad, or otherwise, even if it's bad, let us know, because we're going to read it out anyway, at Need a Bigger Pod for all correspondence for the time being until we get that set up. Sean, thank you.
Thank you, sir. That was a real pleasure. Can't wait for the next one.
And we will back episode... We will back? That's not even a sentence, John. We will be back with episode 2 with the most magnificent Mr. Mark Mothersbaugh. And what an episode that's going to be.
that interview is hilarious.
It is hilarious. Yeah. Keep an eye on this channel, at Need a Bigger Pod, on all socials. And, of course, just check us out. We're going to Need a Bigger Pod on Spotify, Google, Apple, Audio Boo, Deezer, Podchaser, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcast. Thank you very much. Until next time, keep collecting those soundtracks. You must, because we're watching you. Honest.